come over?
You like some tea?
I just made some coffee. You know, I'm just welcome to join me.
There's a hop, skip, and a jump over there.
Where are James and Justin calling from?
I'm from Toronto, and Justin's from Vernon in British Columbia.
It's afternoon for you, right, James?
Yep.
Okay, so you've already had your coffee.
Yep.
It doesn't mean anything. I'm on the East Coast. I'm just starting.
Well, who knows what time it is for you, Alan?
I haven't figured that out yet. I have no sense of any of that. James, it's good to talk to you. I've really enjoyed what you guys do on the Riotfish website. I really, really like it. And then what you guys did for the Sync book is just sort of all just really, really good. Super impressed. And obviously, I don't know. I don't want to say too much now. I'd like to make sure it's all part of the call, but I just want to let you know I'm really, really impressed with what you guys did.
Thanks.
Yeah, I'm really interested to hear about your process of how you guys produce these, because I agree, they're incredible.
Thanks. Was the show already started?
Well,
I think as long as we're having some sort of technical issue, we should just take it really slow and easy, because we're probably going to have some calling and hanging up and stuff like that. So,
well, we haven't cued the theme music yet, so we got enough brilliant minds out there. Can we get an official theme song? Are we looking for like early 80s or? Or maybe we should have a song from 1989 today as a nod to the Riotfish gang.
We need like the Perfect Strangers theme song.
Welcome back, Cotter, maybe. Welcome back. All right.
So just so you know, James, technically I am recording, but you know this stuff will probably be chopped off. But just in case anything spectacular occurred, we would have it for who knows, for the right occasion.
We might time stretch and reverse it too. Oh, sorry.
Yeah. What treasures might be buried inside this audio? I gotta be honest with you, that shit freaked me out, man. I've never had the capabilities to kind of work with audio in that way. And after watching that Winged Beetle stuff, where all, like, the predominant, like, evidence he uses is a lot of the backward masking, right? Whoa. I think we have Justin.
Hello.
Hey.
Hey, yeah, that worked.
Hey, I had to switch computers. That was unbelievable.
Well, thank you for doing it. We're happy to, this is working out.
No worries. Well, so far, so good. I haven't even had a sip of coffee yet, so let's put it that way.
That's an interesting, Get yourself a cup. I just, literally just had a sip. I was like, all right, this coffee's sitting here, and I think I need to start it.
Yeah. I got it in hand, so.
All right.
Is James there?
Yep.
Okay, so who do we got here? William Claus, that's Bill.
Hey, what's going on, Justin?
Hey, not much. Just trying to ignore all of the frustration I just went through over the last 15 minutes.
You're doing a fantastic job.
Yeah. And MK Ultrasound, that's
me. That's David.
David. Okay.
Hi.
Buddy.
So you probably, you've interacted with these guys on Facebook.
Yeah, like... I just realized that Bill is William, was it William John on Facebook?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, I had no idea who Bill of Always Record was on Facebook, actually. So
I'm DVD Platypus, so if you recognize that.
Yeah. Right.
We all have superhero names. I love it.
Yeah.
It's funny, you know, the header I use for that that Facebook group, it came from what I decided was going to be my superhero name. I saw I was on vacation and I saw this sink that says Insinkerator, and I was like, yeah, that's it. That's my
garbage. Some
people have these like really weird, you know, internet handles that they use, and it's like they sound almost like superhero names. I'm like, so, you know, speaking of which, where does Riot Fish come from?
Let me see here. That probably just came out of a sketchbook drawing. I just drew a character when I was like 17 or 18 years old, and I remained in the sketchbook for the longest time, and I eventually just kept looking back to him. So I eventually sort of developed, he just sort of stayed with me over the years. And I started out sort of as a musical muse. So I named my electronic music project that nobody ever listened to, Riot Fish for a while. So, and then we decided to name a website after it, and, but yeah, there is a character, an actual figure behind it. So, he's sort of like Alan Moore's Glycon, but less serious and less well thought out. Much more spontaneous, though. Sort of a, in my imagination, he's a character in a 2D realm that hoots and hollers and has fun all of the time. That's really kind of hard to explain, but I am. Oh my god! I just woke up. So
no,
I'm not used to having this Skype headset on. So, So James, are you there? I just need to make a shout out.
I'm not used to living in a 2D world. It's all right.
Yeah.
What do I sound like? It's like a...
Sound fine. You sound like a voice in the from the ethers.
Yeah, everybody sounds like they have the same levels. So,
I mean, this is the interesting thing. So you're talking about this man who, you know, Riot Fish that lives in the 2D world. Now he's hooting and hollering, but
yeah,
you guys have the. On your web comic, you have this character that's living out this sort of 2D experience. It's this sort of existential examination of this guy living this 2D experience. Now, is that like a sort of 2D element analyzed at all in your creative process, or is this thing where it's more about his existential crisis of being in the comic strip?
Oh, well, that dude isn't Riot Fish. He's someone else. That's
sure. No.
Yeah.
You know, we're synchromistics. It's all commonality, man.
Right. Well, James might have a better explanation for that. That just sort of came about, like a lot of these things did. So, I think initially we just tried to come up with an idea for a webcomic, because we just wanted to put because we had an idea of what a web comic was 6 years ago. And so we thought, hey, let's stick a dude in an actual newspaper comic strip and see how he deals with it. And he's been dealing with it for the last 6 years. So kind of like, I don't know. We have a very close relationship with him. But James actually probably spends more time in his headspace than I do. So, James.
Yeah. I have to impersonate him to write the story to see what he does next.
Yeah, it's really, really weird. We're down there on the page with him, so it's not like writing other pieces.
So it's not the same as, it's not like you're watching this lab rat in a maze where you put the character there and you're watching him. You're sort of holding his hand and stepping into the crisis.
Well, that's actually not true because we're kind of mean towards him. Like, we know what's going on with him, but we don't, like, we haven't stepped in and you know, we haven't broken the fourth wall personally with him, but kind of we have a sense of what he's going through. So, I don't know, are we evil, James? I mean, he's sort of a little homunculus that we poke at, but we're not in any better a position than he is, I don't think.
I view his existence as a sort of a continued consequence of the first strip.
Yeah, we did the first strip and we decided he was going to have a story and
you
guys
hear that because I have to attend to something.
Yeah, not a problem. He has to attend to his little man.
I'm really I appreciate collaborative efforts, like when people can pull that off. I'm really curious of you guys' process. How you do that?
Well, let me think here. We do it all online, pretty much. Like even when James lived in the same general area as I did, we didn't really get together and do that sort of do this. So. Geez, it's we just basically trade ideas and we do use some online stuff. James used to be a sysop of a BBS, so we've been sort of chatting, I guess, even before the internet was together, so it's I guess the electronic end of things has actually been very important over the years for the creation of this stuff. So I think one of the first things we ever collaborated on was a role-playing game submission for Palladium Games, a Robotech game, actually. And where was I going with this? Oh, my God. I am really not on the ball today, guys.
No
There's
worries.
No pressure here. This is. Yeah. I know you've listened to our show.
Yeah, I know.
It's a very informal space.
Yeah. It's kind of awkward because I'm really used to like your guys' flow, and so I'm just like, wow, that's really cool. But I can't sit back and let you guys do the work on this one. So.
Whatever.
We can tell you about our website, riotfish.com, but.
Yeah.
Bill does all the artwork.
Y'all, dude, strictly pencils. David does coloring.
So yeah, that's what I'm curious of. Do you guys both draw or
I think we met actually. It's kind of weird. We met in it was a little animation course. I think neither of us had started high school yet, so we were in what, grade 6 or 7. I think it was this little locally developed thing down at the Boys and Girls Club. And it was just like a 1 or 2 day course. It was like stop motion animation. I think I brought down Robotech toys and stuff and animated those. But yeah, that's sort of how we sort of met. And then we were in high school together the next year. But yeah, and we were in art classes and shit. So, but we didn't start drawing comics together until we were out of high school. James draws, but it's not like he's not. I handle pretty much all the finished art for the website. So we do back and forth. He can thumbnail and stuff and write, and I thumbnail and write. So we kick things back and forth. So it's things arise sort of organically, I guess.
So you guys grew, like, in a sense, grew up together to a certain degree, and then you split apart, and you still work through the internet means. That's great.
Yeah.
In a strange circumstance, reunited us after high school.
Yeah. Wow, that's a dark period, man. That's a bit of a joke. It was a... Should I even be telling them this stuff? It was a D&D group. Dungeons and Dragons, guys.
Yep.
That's really interesting. I listened to the latest 42 Minutes yesterday, and they were talking about D&D groups. That's really interesting.
So, yeah, I don't know if that's important, but actually, I'd say that I'd call James... I'm not, like, a big gamer. I don't game anymore, but James... I'd call him a master DM or dungeon master.
Thanks.
You know, I heard, I listened to the 42 Minutes yesterday as well, and it forced me to kind of revisit my own memories of Dungeons and Dragons and how what is essentially, you know, an imagination-based board game, why it just got buried under so much propaganda and it's just awful associations. Because thinking back on it, I had a cousin from Tennessee who, when he came up to Chicago, he wanted to play Dungeons and Dragons, and I had a little bit of some of the press's, you know, associations with the game, and I found after 3 hours of playing it that, you know, it's a pretty fantastic little game, you know. As opposed to, you know, playing Atari or whatever other stuff was around for 10, 11-year-olds. But I kind of have the feeling that a game like that is poised to make a comeback within the next decade or so. Anyone else kind of feel that way? Or do you think that's something that is sort of on its last legs or is completely extinguished?
I think some people who play it all the time would be like, come back.
Yeah.
What's happening?
I mean, how big is that community out there? Is it...
James can speak to that better than I can.
Well, I don't know.
Man.
There's new editions coming out, and I'm sort of jaded about investing in them or playing them anymore, because they're not... They've been, like, bought out, and...
Isn't it essentially World of Warcraft now or something? Like, the rule system? Yeah. That's how I had it explained to me once.
Yeah, that's fourth edition. They changed whatever was imagined about D&D before and made it more like a board game. More like playing World of Warcraft, except you have to do more paperwork to play it.
But the nice thing is that you presumably wouldn't have to, quote-unquote, upgrade to their latest version, right? I mean...
Yeah,
I think, and even, and then again, even if you don't want to stay in that, again, I've actually never played it, but from what I gather, I mean, this is something where they might give you a sort of basic set of guidelines, but you get to sort of create your own world, and you could take that format and very easily run with it.
Oh, yeah.
I would actually argue that's probably what any of us who write some sort of fiction story, if you're doing a comic strip or you're doing anything, it's essentially the same thing. As the writer artist of a comic strip, you are the sort of dungeon master of the newspaper comic strip guy that you put into this world, and you get to sort of dictate some of his actions. And then there's this other sort of strange creative element that comes in, and that character takes on a life of its own, and you get to sort of guide it here and there. But
yeah. I'd say that's right, isn't it, James? I mean,
I don't think for you.
Uh-oh, cross chatter.
I really like your latest piece that you did for the your SyncBook 2 contribution. I resonated with it like extremely. Like I just. First of all, like the Oppenheimer thing I included in my chapter, I talk about that, and it's like a huge thing. I was connecting the whole like Jack Parsons' L. Ron Hubbard Moonchild idea to the nuclear blast and LSD, and went down this whole chain with it. And so like I like the illustrating what that was, like the centerpiece being this giant mushroom cloud and then everything kind of like reverberations from it and just how it expresses itself in all these different ways. And it all syncs up on different like substratum levels and stuff. I really appreciated that. I thought it was great.
Thanks. Well, I did you made it a sync book piece. It wasn't just a Riot Fish piece. So, the structure was kind of strange on that one. I just knew that I wanted to, I just very early on got to be in my bonnet that I wanted to start. Actually, should I even be talking about the structure of the piece? Well, should I like it's got a unique structure to it, as anybody who's seen the strip probably knows, but
yeah, I think it's quite difficult to speak to, but I don't think there's any worry of spoilers. I mean, the book's going to be out in a few weeks, and people will be able to see it soon enough. But if you are able to speak to that structure, good luck.
It took us a month to describe it to each other. Like, we both had different ideas on what we were talking about when we were trying to come up with that.
Yeah, Man, I became a real asshole on this project. It almost drove me insane, quite literally. So, but personally, it was really worth it because there was something I was definitely after with this one. And the primary image I was going with, and it was sort of rolling around in the sync book stuff that I was immersing myself in. Always record podcasts, random blogs and things. But yeah, the mushroom cloud and the tree were the two big ones for me. So yeah, as you know, the comic itself for the sync book starts in the center and sort of branches out. And I really wanted that central tree or mushroom cloud or whatever, because it's not any one of those specific things, right? So, and the rest just sort of fell into place. James came up with most of the actual comic, quote unquote, comic parts of that. So,
is it your intention that someone, when you say it starts from the center, is your intention that someone reads like the first half basically from the center and then moves backwards, essentially reading right to left on those pages?
Yeah, I kind of wanted to give it a split down the middle. I don't know why exactly.
That's what Adam did.
Yeah, there's all kinds of reasons. I had Fukushima was heavily on my mind. It's been heavily on my mind for the last few months, and I, for obvious reasons, and. Yeah, so that was just one of those things. I was like, oh, well, in Japan, they, you know, things are read from right to left. So that was one of those things. I'm like, oh, well, that kind of works, because I was thinking about Japan. I was thinking about Miyazaki's Nausicaa manga and stuff like that, because I was using that as a bit of a touchstone, stylistic touchstone. So yeah, that was just one of the reasons. And then I wanted another, but I also wanted to show the left to right side. I just wanted to break it up, because if it had just been a left to right comic, that just, it would have been a comic recognizable as such. But
well, I think it makes people work to find out what's going on in there.
Yeah,
I love that idea that it's not a, you pick up the book, you read your chapter, and then you've processed it, and it's over with. That because of the structure of it, anyone with any kind of perception and anyone who's understanding the book should get that feeling that there's something more to your chapter, and when revisiting it can kind of start to piece together what was sort of the intention behind it. And so I guess I kind of understand a sort of hesitation to kind of make that explicit today, you know, because you kind of want that reader to have that sort of that virgin experience of entering into your world of that chapter. And because of the print, because of the laws of print that tell us, oh, it's left to right, you know, pages 100, then 101, 102, that you kind of have to ignore those laws and find out what the laws were that were embedded in it by the creators. And I really like the beauty of that chapter and how it's laid out like that.
Hmm. Hello, Griff. I'm just going to keep saying unless somebody else jumps in.
It's like the cut-up method, right? I mean, that's like, but yeah, that was the immediate, like, as soon as I started looking at it, I'm like, oh, okay, dig it. Like, Burroughs got some cut-up method. Cool.
We do a strip called, we haven't done one in about a year or two, but it's called Random Commercial Parody. And we started, they're just basically, well, it's pretty much exactly what it says on the tin. But I'd say that the last random commercial parody that we were working on was we were calling it the Fugue Strip, and we haven't even finished it yet. So it's the structure is very similar there. We sort of
part of the idea of that is if you watch commercials, you change the channel, so you switch between one and the other pretty quickly. And then in the commercial field, you start blending into each other.
Yes.
You know,
single stream made out of. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, it's just I love that because really commercial narratives are exactly the same. All commercial narratives are exactly the same when you really boil them down to their essence. It almost as if, you know, they talk about the monomyth and there's really only one story and you might tell it in horror or drama or comedy. There's sort of this advertising doesn't really, it's sort of the bastard child or demon child of art in a sense, right? I mean, it's I saw the random commercial parody strips, and I really liked what you were doing with that. But I think to isolate on commercials as itself, and then to work with it in an artistic way, there's a feedback that occurs in there that is very strange. I don't know. That's just what made me think of.
Yeah, I have to say that's like those strips are some of my favorite. I think there's a sort of, you know, there is a sort of satire, almost, you know, obviously showing these commercials to be, in one sense, mentally insulting and possibly morally insulting and all this sort of stuff. So there's a criticism in there, and yet there's also, at the same time, you're elevating the commercials to art. I don't know if that's what you would intend to do, but that's what ends up happening is you sort of, you know, taking it almost is like a collage where you're cutting up, you know, the worst source material that you could find and turning it into something much more interesting and elevating it, to be sure.
Yeah, shit into gold. Are we allowed to swear?
Fucking A.
Okay.
Who the fuck's gonna tell me I can't swear on my own fucking show?
Come on now. Okay. Come on.
Come on.
That reminds me of those turd polish videos that Severed Heads guy did.
Turd polish. Well, it's good that he brought up Severed Heads because they worked with Skinny Puppy back in the day. Talking about the industrial music band Skinny Puppy from Vancouver. And me and James listened to a shitload of Skinny Puppy in high school. And still do, I guess. Their sampling and cut up technique of very influential on us, I'd say.
It's amazing that you just mentioned that band because I actually just sort of researched them out of curiosity because their name popped up in my head, and there was always like a few guys in high school who had Skinny Puppy shirts on, and when Too Dark Park came out, it was like. They all like were arm in arm, and like they seemed like they all wore their shirts together on the same day to let us know that, you know, Skinny Puppy's in town, we're hitting the show, and this is where it's at, you know, very much in line with don't know, like the front 242. They're just, you know, classic high school arm-in-arm t-shirt kind of gangs, you know, front 242, Eisenstein, Neubauten, Skinny Puppy. And going back to look at Skinny Puppy, and the, God damn, the internet is genius, because you can get the interviews, you can get the live footage, and you can kind of get a sense from where what these human beings were behind the t-shirts, and really genius stuff, and real deep and meaningful, and really commendable artists to the highest degree. And I'm not saying that the people who wore those t-shirts were bad advertisements for the music and the band, but definitely for my white bread ass, it kind of was kind of a deterrent. I don't know. It was threatening to me, because I just didn't want to go there.
I think over the years I've definitely underestimated how disturbing Skinny Puppy is, and probably have underestimated the effect they've had on my psyche. I don't know about James, but what can I say about Skinny Puppy? They were, I mean, they were struggling heroin addicts for the longest time. So, I mean, they pulled through all of that, but they picked up on something really gross and icky out of the port city of Vancouver in the 80s. And on one sense, they made it artful, but on the other sense, it's like, I don't know.
Like, to some guy who's ever heard of them, they look like people that put on like blood shows with strange sounding vocals.
I mean, well, that's exactly what they were. They were very theatrical back then. It was like it was a big theater sort of thing for them in the 80s, at least. The guitars and things sort of came later, so.
But I love how they toured with the message of, the violence against animals and animal testing, and that, you know, behind it all, they were carrying a message, a very real message. And I don't even know if it was political in the sense that it was just, you look at some of the footage of, you know, the lead singer covered in blood and the growling and the torture that seems to be emanating from the sound and vision of their show. And it is disturbing and scary, but it's fake. And yet they carry this message of cruelty to animals, which is real. And that should be the thing that, at the end of the day, that's the thing that should disturb you, right? That's the thing you should carry home with you that is the real horror that they're trying to project. And I just find that the way that they went about it is was almost too subtle in an age where my only real exposure to them was the guy in the t-shirt in the hallway of my high school. You know, there's something fascinatingly brave about the way they chose to carry their message that I think is maybe if it was lost for a decade or two, I think that because of the internet, it'll be reborn in some fashion. Like their day, they'll have another day where they will be regarded as artists. I don't think they're lost to time, and I think that's a testament to how they went about it, really.
James, say something.
Well, I think, someone listened to a lot of Skinny Puppy in the 80s and 90s. They might now be environmental activists or animal rights activists.
Yeah, I wore a Skinny Puppy t-shirt to dental cleaning about 10 years ago, and my hygienist recognized the shirt, and she's like, oh, I listened to them when I was blah, blah, blah. What was that song that they had? And she named some song from, like, it was like 84 or 85. It was like, and I, of course, made a gaffe. I was like, oh, wow, that was a long time ago. And that was the wrong thing to say to her. But can't remember where I was going with that.
was your dental did your dental hygienist like to torture animals, or was she an environmental activist?
We didn't really go into it. No, I don't. She had a cushy job. as a hygienist.
It wasn't like Little Shop of Horrors?
No.
With the leader of the plaque?
Is that a cushy job? I think you're making pretty good money, but I don't know if you could say that's cushy. You get to sit around and clean people's teeth.
Yeah, it's probably pretty gross. Just to have to be nice to people. To have to be nice to people while you're in their mouth, day in day out. So,
I bet she judged you a little bit when you're
teeth. I'm a pretty bad for that. Just letting it slip out like that. But you guys should have a conversation about something while I go get myself another coffee, because I'm really hurting here.
Talk amongst yourselves.
Yeah.
Go get some coffee, bro.
I'll be right back.
I got a root canal once. And they had like a open CD player that they were like looking for a CD, and they're like, hey, if you have a CD, you know, you can put it on. And I run out to my car from this place, and I come back in, and it's a guy called Gerald, which is drum and bass. So it's like, it's not like jungle, but it's like, you know, it's drum and bass. And I put it on, and they worked on my teeth and let the whole album play through. But I didn't realize initially that like the CD player spread to every room. So there's like all these other people getting like dental work done, and they were all listening to drum and bass. And the dentist was actually like totally cool about it and was like, you know, this is really fitting music for what's happening right now. I was like, wow. I was like really surprised that they let me do that.
If you knew ahead of time, you could have put a CD of people screaming on there.
They wouldn't have let it play through though. It had to be just enough so that it was like agreeable, you know, like I was modeling the other night for a drawing class, and I requested to listen to Tool Push It Live, which is like saliva,
is that a
like
cover
you know. What's that?
Is that a cover of the Salt and Pepper song?
No. It's not, but that would be really awesome if Tool did a cover of Salt and Pepper's Push It. But no, it's a fucking beautiful song. If you look up Tool's Salival Push It Live, the song is called Push It, the album's called Salival. It's one of my very favorite Tool songs, but it's really fucking heavy and super intense. And I could tell that it pissed the teacher off kind of, and I didn't really care cuz whatever. Yeah. But all the kids liked it, and that's what's important. So it was like mostly younger people. They were like all in their early 20s or whatever. But, you know, I like the thing with like Skinny Puppy, who also played, his last tour was with Otto Van Schirok, who I just saw this Halloween. And a friend of mine was really concerned when he first started, because they were expecting like dance music. You know, and it's like, this isn't really dance music per se. This is like super fucking intense. Like, and she's like, do you like this? You know, because her boyfriend booked him and he was the headliner, Otto Van Schirok. I don't know if you guys are familiar, but it was like, you know, I'm trying to explain it to her on the spot, and I could tell she was having a heavy time. And I'm like, no, it's like a bad trip, but you got to embrace it, you know? It's like, and like, she's like, why would you want to do that? And I'm like, it's like, that's like a thing in therapy. Like, if you have fucking post-traumatic stress disorder, you don't go away from the memory, you fucking face it. You like, you take the thing on, and you know, you challenge yourself. And like, that's like a real therapeutic tool, you know, and it's hard to explain to someone on the spot who's feeling vulnerable and then just like, I don't know if this is what I want, you know. But he was great. He's awesome. He's gotten more danceable than he used to be. But when he was playing with Skinny Puppy, he was just like, he really didn't hold back with like, you know, really aggressive, just out there crazy shit. And you know,
I'm sorry, I missed the opening of that. Sorry, who were you talking about? I'm just curious.
Otto Van Schirok.
Oh.
Van Schirok, like he's from Miami or whatever, but he has this whole
Isn't Kevin Key or whatever working with him these days on some sort of new project, or am I thinking of somebody else?
I don't know, it could be him. Yeah, he's definitely he's collaborated with a lot of people. Yeah,
I just know he's working with somebody out of Florida these days. So.
Well, he's from Miami, so that's very possible.
Yeah.
Well, Alan, just to go to that idea of the bad trip. I mean, the Happy Creatures book, the Look at All the Happy Creatures book. Every person who's read it said it reads like a bad acid trip, and writing it was definitely a one really long bad acid trip. Not like literally, but essentially, he's going into this really dark headspaces. And I'm just curious, you know, as you guys also doing these stories, I mean, is this something where it's a therapy for you? And I noticed, you know, I'm very glad you guys are not shying away from the darker topics. Is this a therapy for you to process some of those darker topics, or how would you look at that?
I don't see that there's any way to avoid the darker topics, because sort of a ground reality. So, and Skinny Puppy pretty much sort of summed that up. I mean, it's like when I was growing up in the 80s and in the interior of BC, and they sort of, you know, they one of the few ways of dealing with the angst of growing up under nuclear threat and environmental disaster and war and all the other just vile shit that goes on. So, James?
Was someone saying that the moon...
Oops, sorry.
What's that?
That was Wolfman Jack. I don't know if you heard that. I think that's... Is that Chewbacca? That was weird. My phone rang with my Wolfman Jack scream.
It's hilarious. I guess it all day. I don't hear it anymore.
Did you teach him how to do the Wookiee sound?
No.
That's just what comes now.
So he processes things and he's simulated. He makes it sound.
I'm gonna have to try that.
Sorry, guys.
Oh, no worries. We're gonna do a show where James's son and John Fell Ryan's son can just talk the whole time. It's actually, I find it really nice. I think that for me personally, I mean, I don't know the listener that just that comes in, but I have to say, I think there's this really nice thing that I get to have these conversations and also hear someone in a sort of family environment, and it's just very grounding, and I think there's, I don't know, it puts a human element back into it. For sure.
Probably.
Yeah, like I had to, I mean, preparing for the Sync book, I think the main thing for me was just sitting down with a lot of Always Record and just listening to that, so... I feel kind of strange because I feel like I already know you guys because I've listened to like hours and hours of you guys just shooting the shit. So,
cool. Awesome.
So that's the best way for me, at least over the years, is listening to podcasts, and you can sort of over time you can tell what people are like, and that's really important. The actual, like the even the emotional responses and you know, how consistent people are over time. So, I mean, I used to listen to a lot of different podcasts, so, and then I realized, then suddenly here I'm talking on a podcast, so.
Well, what I think is kind of eerie is that, you know, I grew up on talk radio. I listened to hundreds of thousands of hours of talk radio, getting up in the morning before school, after school. And then, obviously, when you get your first car, I listen to it. But to have truly...
Here, just a sec. I'm just going to tell James to mute his microphone.
Oh, okay. He's up to something. We're gonna find that first.
Oh wow.
We're Canadians. We're really sorry.
What do Canadians have to be sorry for? We're the ones that need to apologize.
Well,
we're the leaders of genocide and everything.
And don't you forget it.
That you have to angst against.
Which is coming exactly right into my point, is that is that independent podcasting, devoid of any advertising, devoid of any outside pressure or whatever, to really hear kind of without any real agenda or towards any real major point, and not in a bad way, but I think I'm jealous of young people who get to kind of go through all the thousands of podcasts and to find voices out there that are speaking kind of freely. I mean, it's kind of a dream come true for American media. And I just really don't know how long that's going to last. So I think that the fact that you can find independent radio streaming for free on the internet, and then for in your case to have a completely multimedia website like Riotfish, where you have comics that are without any sort of corporate or advertising or financial interest or any outside voices telling you what you can and cannot do, there's something very exciting about that. I guess the thing that's difficult is that because there's so many choices, how do you find the right ones? I guess that's sort of the give and the take of it all. And I think it's not necessarily a setback.
My interests led me through it, so yeah, but it's really hard for me to think about that. It's like, I guess, let me think here.
Well, just to kind of say that, like, I read that one comment section on one of your latest strips where someone wrote in saying, you know, I read your website and I like the work you've been doing, but I don't comment on it. And I know that there are people out there like me who are a little shy or don't feel like they have anything to contribute in the comment section. And they don't even really take the time just to say, hey, great job. But I think people will start getting over that hump, in the sense that you don't have to donate money to an artist on the web, but just donating that 5 seconds to leave a comment that you're just enjoying it, I think that more people see that. Basically what I'm just saying is that wall will come tumbling down, and I think artists who get recognition will be, they'll remember why people create art in the first place. It was never about dollars. You know, I'm kind of sick of hearing musicians bitch and moan about how they can't get paid, and this whole thing is that they've crossed over completely into show business and they've forgotten why they made music in the first place. And that I'm sure that if there are a couple hundred people out there who are dedicated readers of the work that you create, and right now they're anonymous, if they all kind of just got together and started to leave comments or thumbs up or whatever it is, I'm sure it would have a huge impact on the work that you do. More so than someone giving you $5,000 to write a comic strip for a bag of potato chips or something.
There's a saying, he who pays the piper calls the tune.
Exactly.
Yeah, you know, but I feel like there's a way to find that middle ground, which is that we don't have to all be starving artists, and yet we don't have to be sellouts either. I think with advances in crowdsourcing and donations and all this sort of stuff, yeah, to say no one needs to donate if they can't, a thumbs up is certainly helpful, or a comment is certainly helpful to kind of keep the morale going. But ultimately, I don't think, you know, James has a child to support. We all have rent to pay. I'm sort of in this spot where I see there's the old artistic idea of, oh no, man, I'm just as an artist. Or there's the new artistic idea, which is, fuck yeah, I'm a sellout. Because I see a lot of that too. And I think that I would like to see a middle ground where artists are supported, but supported for what they do. We've all had the gig where you know, someone hires you and says, I think it should be more like this. And it's like, hey man, you hired me because you like what I do. Let me do it. You know, so there's no moral advantage in being a sellout. It strips the artwork of anything. But if we could find a middle ground where artists are supported, but supported for the art that they love to create, people love to create, that would be nice.
Everyone there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, I'm here. Just Griff's tweeting this moment to shout something.
Yeah, because I think once you start, well, the middle ground. Where is the middle ground? There's a very strange place, I imagine, for the artist who makes that first leap into professional, right? Where the money starts coming in to a degree that one can sort of completely eliminate the concept of the day job. And there becomes this sort of balancing act where opportunities will arise and choices need to be made, because what happens if you have to fall back into the world of the day job? That is, I guess that's what they call the crossroads, I imagine, when one gets to that point. Because one little project for a little bit of money to get through the month might be so successful that it all of a sudden becomes your identity as an artist. And once that happens, then you're kind of fucked, I think. Like the right hit song can completely screw a band's career for the rest of their lives, depending on how far it reaches.
It's a jingle in the commercial.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many bands now that when they have a record come out and I go, I never heard of that band, and the record's playing, and then it comes to a song that I've heard 30 seconds of in a commercial, that album for me completely is destroyed. And there are tons of these bands that have just a clip from their song that are used as the background of a commercial. And I know a band has a tough choice to make, because I'm sure the money is astounding, relatively speaking, to where they are in their careers. And the notoriety is great, but I guess it's just the classic story, you know? It's been around for many, many decades now, and there's nothing really new to cover about it, you know, the art of selling out. But once you do that, I think the middle ground is just destroyed. I mean,
it's weird how it contaminates it in this weird way. It's like, you know, Pink Floyd or The Doors, like, you'll never see on a fucking commercial. And that makes you feel better about the band. There's, like, still something sacred there or something. It's weird how that works.
Absolutely.
Didn't The Doors sell...
One song, Light My Fire, and then it was retracted when Morrison found out about it. They did it without Morrison, and he was like, what the fuck are you doing? Isn't that how it worked?
Absolutely. He got back from the desert caves or wherever he was, and they like, hey, we just got paid for this. And he's like, fuck that bullshit. Rip up the contract. Give the money back. We're not doing that.
It was a car commercial.
Yeah.
So I wonder if the band has control over whether their song's used or not.
Right,
if someone really surprised to hear them as jingles, like Pictures of You was used to sell HP printers.
That's a Cure song?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you're a DJ, right, David?
I am, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So have you heard of... I just learned about this a few days ago. I'd never heard of it before. Like, I heard about the event thing called the Boiler Room, but I just learned about the Red Bull Music Academy the other day from a friend who lives in San Francisco and is really into live electronic music and stuff. And that just threw me for a loop because it's a whole experimental, cutting-edge electronic music thing where they hold these events called the Boiler Room in various cities, and they live cast them and stuff. And my friend was trying to explain that, you know, a lot of artists have, you know, been supported through this, like talented people. And, you know, he said, no, it's easy to be cynical about that. But I was just like, what? Red Bull?
Yeah, that's so weird. I was just, okay, so I've heard of that. I don't know that much about it. But I was tripping out on fucking Red Bull paid for the biggest, longest free fall that's ever happened in human history. Like from basically the edge of the atmosphere, this guy just like drops off free fall speed, and then eventually a parachute opens, and it's insane. Like they film this and all these people are monitoring it. It's like totally like Houston, you know? And like, I'm just like, wow, that was paid for by Red Bull. Like Red Bull has like been doing some interesting things like that. You know, I'm not one to just be like, oh, well, because something's a corporation or because something makes money, that automatically it's like can't be helpful or that it's just straight up evil. You know, like I have my feeling on certain corporations like fucking Monsanto. I can't help but not feel very positive about, you know, and I found Red Bull to be helpful very few times in my life, you know, where I'm on a trip and I need to, like, on my way to the sink cabin, like Red Bull was a friend, you know, like I had to drive, you know, like, and it helped me do that. Like long distance driving, like, hell yeah, drink a Red Bull, you know? But I can't imagine drinking that regularly. That would just tweak me out, you know? I can't see that being very healthy, but yeah, I don't know. Yeah. It's a thing. There's no completely fixed rules like with anything. You can't just be like, oh well, this is just, you know, you can't have any corporate anything. I mean, yeah
I was having this same conversation last night. Very similar. My wife was looking at my wife's very into organic foods, raw foods, things like that, and there was a company that she liked and they got bought out by Kraft, and she was very upset
about
it.
Which is Monsanto.
Right.
Monsanto is Kraft, yeah.
Yeah, so she was like, how the fuck do you, you know, can you have an organic food company being put out by Kraft? And then, you know, does this, you assume, they automatically assume that it's going to be some sort of change in their process there. If not right away, then certainly soon behind. And she was looking at this chart that had all the food companies and that what they own of the quote-unquote natural products were actually, how many of them are actually umbrella corporations, or under umbrella corporations, excuse me. And she's looking at this like chart of, you know, how it's all under these very few companies. And I was talking to her how I look at charts like that for media, how you see all the media is owned and gets consolidated into these umbrellas. And I was saying, you know, the bad thing is, I guess I'll just sort of say it. So it's like, I was thinking, you couldn't have, even if you raised a bunch of money to put out a commercial saying, this shit is toxic, well, you couldn't put that commercial on TV because people wouldn't let you, you know, the Channel 4 is not going to let you run that commercial on their TV because then you run the risk of offending your other advertisers or maybe even the company that you own or owns you. So you're not going to do that. And I was thinking, it's just, so it's, we know it's a straight up control system. It's fascist corporatism in its, you know, ultimate sense. It really is that. And yet it seems to me that if you want to have if you want to have fascism, which I don't think many of us do, but if you wanted to actually have fascism, the idea would be that it would be efficient, and if you want to be into corporatism, the idea would be that you'd be focused on profits. It, well, it makes sense to me that you would allow, you know, so Kraft puts their commercial on saying, buy our toxic waste food, and then you'd have someone else run a commercial saying, hey man, don't eat that, that shit's toxic waste. And then you get to sell another advertisement to Kraft where they defend their position. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in this sense, like, I guess I was trying to get to this sense that freedom of speech actually could be profitable for the media empire. Not, you know, not that that's the focus. It just sort of seems an extra step backwards to me. Like, it's obviously backwards on one level, and then just that extra step of they could actually, you know, instead of worrying about offending their advertisers, they could, the same way like in a political campaign, they're going to run an advertisement from the Republican and they're going to run an advertisement from the Democrat arguing with each other. And I said, you know, obviously that I think points to something where if you can have the two opposing political parties run advertisements on TV and that's not a problem, it's proof that it's one control system, that they know, you know, that's allowed to happen because there's no real change that's going to come from it. But mm-hmm. you won't see anything that's run advertising against Kraft, let's say, or any of these food products.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, it was slipping to duality so quickly, like organic versus non-organic, GMO versus non-GMO, and like watching some of these, just the arguments online and elsewhere, the pro-GMO people, let's say, there's a lot of people saying, oh, well, the organics, it's a billion-dollar industry, and it is. I mean, there is this thing going on where you sort of, I don't know, it's like almost like watching people become what they hate. It's hard to say, like, what,
right.
I don't know exact, I mean, you can't just say, oh, there's this whole big organic industry and say that they're a big monolithic sort of thing, but there's like people actually writing books and stuff saying that the organic industry, like they're trying to use sort of political language, saying that, oh, well, this is how the commies are going to get us sort of thing. And they just want to set up this socialist. Like, people actually say these things. What's the one dude? He's from here in the Okanagan in British Columbia. But I actually heard he wrote a book on this whole thing about why the organics industry is evil and whatnot. But there was a recording of him at what's called a Crop Life Canada conference. Back in 2007, this was in Saskatchewan. It's basically just a bunch of industry people getting together to talk about stuff.
Monsanto and DuPont, yeah. And whatever the hell it is.
And that fellow, and he's an ex-organics, organic inspector, so he's sort of running this whole thing where he's like, oh yeah, I was on the inside, and these people aren't who they're. It's the whole fake hippie thing. I don't know how...
No, totally. All the standards dropped, right? I mean, they changed what defined organic at one point. What was it? Fucking 8 years ago or something. And since then, they can charge more for something that's organic, too. It has that label.
And a lot of people only see that, though. They see, oh, well, it's just another group of people trying to make money, but they're kind of missing, I think, the point. I mean, the whole thing is ridiculous to me. I don't think organics, I mean, it is a standard that does support an industry, but the whole point of bringing up the dude from the Okanagan was that he stood up and asked a question of the head of Monsanto Canada, and he basically said, how long do you think it's going to take before we can get GMOs to be included in organic certifications? And the guy sort of laughed and said, well, we'd actually really like that situation to occur, if it were to happen, I'd have to look it up, but it was like really startling. They want to change the standards.
Then they tell people that want GMOs labeled that they already have organic food they can buy if they want it.
Well, exactly. Did we talk about this last week? The idea that everyone was so excited. I mean, a lot of, in my opinion, naive people really excited. We just had the elections in the United States. And people like, oh, yay, Barack Obama's reelected. We got our progressive candidate. And then you have a few states that have marijuana decriminalization, you know, kind of laws. And people like, oh, yay, we got pot. And then every GMO food labeling bill that was up lost. And no one commented on it. I have, you know, there's like, for all, I spent election day monitoring Facebook, which I don't normally do. And just so fucking depressed at seeing all the people who are either arguing about stupid, inconsequential political debates and or getting excited one way or the other. And there was very little talk. Actually, I don't think I saw a single person talk about the fact that the GMO food labeling bills all failed. There's a reason for that. It's like, we gave you pot, you know, here, smoke your pot, shut the fuck up. We're going to give you some GMO foods. Enjoy it.
Pretty good deal.
There's a terrible nothing eating up the land is basically what's happening in the midst of all of this, right? And, you know, I don't remember exactly where I was going with this. But, okay, here's the thing. Fucking, I haven't drank any dairy for the most part. There's been a few exceptions. But since Fuck Yushima, I've almost completely cut it out of my diet just because I'm like, Berkeley cows showing, but basically they had to change the standard for what was permissible in terms of radiation. Otherwise they're going to have to basically end the milk industry. And like, that's not something anybody wants to do. It's like they made these standards so that they would be held because of human safety. But then once something happens that's big enough to make it so it can't exist unless the standards are changed, they're just like, oh, well, okay, well, we'll do what we can, you know, like, whatever, you know. And apparently they've gone down since then, but I still don't, I hardly take any dairy. I found that interesting in your little comic strip there with that, because definitely paid attention to that, have been affected by that. But then it's like, okay, well, I'm making that decision for myself. Do I think I'm going to fucking live forever? I don't think so. You know, like, I'm still, like, mortal and I'm still affected by what's going on, you know, and I can kind of take certain precautionary measures, but they're not... I think that there's, like, an issue there with, like, you're saying, like, the fake, like, hippie thing, where basically you can have this kind of almost, like, fascist phenomenon where you can get kind of holier than thou because of personal health decisions that are being made. And if one's even in an ability to be able to make those decisions, I mean, I have a friend who's been a heavy smoker for years, you know, and she was just like, wow, she had this realization at one point. She was like, wow, how lucky am I to be even struggling with this? Like, how many people can even fucking afford to smoke? Like, most, like, a lot of places, people can't develop much of a habit out of it because they can't fucking afford it, like, to make a habit out of it, you know? So for her to be struggling with something that costs her, you know, $5-6 a pack, you know, is definitely a statement on her position, you know? So, you know, I don't know. I think that there's some ridiculous sides from both ends, you know?
So. Yeah, it's for me, it's more like, it's not like, ooh, I mean, ooh, those fake hippies. It's more like that worries me that there's a perception that there's fake hippies. Because I don't know, it's like GMO versus organic. It's like, it becomes like a language issue directed from the needs of various industries. And there's a ground level understanding that's not there. Like, you're talking about your friend who was spending all of this money. I think who else was talking? I'm a little confused because I just finished up the last Always Record yesterday, and I think somebody was talking about quitting smoking or something and how much money they spent on it. Maybe that was a different podcast. Somebody was talking about buying themselves a laptop. That may have been something I read somewhere completely else. What was I going to say? It's, you went straight to the money thing, but to me, tobacco is just a fucking plant that you can grow in your backyard if you want to.
But it's not genetically modified. If you smoke tobacco that's grown in your backyard, which technically is more illegal than weed, if you grow enough of it, like, you're not allowed to grow tobacco, you know, that's like a big no-no.
It's legal here.
Oh, really? Because
friends here didn't even know that. I had to learn that. There used to be a big industry here in the Okanagan. So, but yeah, there's no issues at all.
I thought you had to do this whole, you had to go through certain channels to be able to do that if you wanted to grow a large amount of it.
Perhaps on so-called industrial scales, but yeah, there's totally personal use, yeah.
I was in the desert in Arizona, and there was a guy who grew a lot of tobacco. He'd been out in the middle of the desert for 30 years and basically dug a giant hole and made like a clay and thatch like roof and had like a stove down in this like thing. And he'd been living there for fucking 30 years. And he grew peanuts and watermelons and grew all his own food and used a sun oven and was just like one of the happier people I'd met. But he smoked tobacco for 30 years and he was like, only the tobacco that he grew, and was like, you know, he never made a problem out of it. It never turned into a problem because it's so fucking harsh that if he tried to make it into a problem, he would get sick, which apparently, you know, Native Americans and whatnot were able to endure and would just keep, you know, they would smoke it to the, you know, to that point anyway. But for the most part, you know, white people at least, you know, it's very challenging to make a habit out of raw, natural, truly natural tobacco. It's like, I mean, American Spirit was bought out by Philip Morris, if I'm correct. And like, when that happened, you know, you could see that there was a slight difference.
Who owns Pall Mall? I think American Spirit got bought out by them.
Yeah, well, American Spirit is no longer, but they were genetically modified to begin with, which is weird. Like, I have friends that smoke American Spirit for years, and they see this, like, this stand at this one convention place for American Spirit, and they're like, oh, awesome, American Spirit. And they walk up, and there's these two people there running it, and they're like telling them how much they love their cigarettes and how they've been smoking them for years. And they're like, yeah, they're like saying all natural, this and that, the people behind the thing. And they're like, yeah, they are genetically modified. And the people were like, what? And they're like, your cigarettes are genetically modified. And they're like, we don't know what that means. And so my friends were less like, okay, are you telling us that you don't know what that means because you genuinely don't know and you need to be educated, or you know and you're just fucking with us right now and you're not going to just come out with and just be honest? And they like basically ended up walking away being like, what the fuck was that? Like, you know, because the people were like completely clueless as to genetically modified. Like, these people are like representatives of American Spirit, and yet they don't know what the term genetically modified means. Like, you know, it's just like, what is that? You know, it doesn't taste like that if it's completely natural. You know, it doesn't go down smooth like that. It's like, whoa, you know. So I don't know.
Don't they have American Spirit Organic?
Yeah. And it's still not like natural. It's still genetically modified, even the organic.
They had natural American Spirit, and now they came out with American Spirit Organic. Like, natural and organic are two different branding categories.
Yeah, and I mean, I
it is in regular food as well, because you can have, you could see a product that says all natural ingredients, but the all natural just means that the chemical compound can be naturally occurring in nature. Even if it's a synthesized version of that chemical compound, as long as it's naturally occurring. So if you synthesize, you know, the acid in an apple, it's all natural ingredients because that's a naturally occurring compound. So that can be labeled all natural. It can be GMO, it can be non-organic, and it can be completely synthesized and still be labeled all natural.
Right.
Interestingly, Sprite or 7-Up or something couldn't call themselves natural anymore because they had high fructose corn syrup in it. There's nothing natural about extracting that strange substance out of corn.
yeah, I don't know, it's sort of a bit of a sidebar, but just for James's purposes, it just, something I learned through the podcast is that Alan here has a background in pharmaceuticals. And I found that really interesting listening to the shows that when that would come up, Alan, when you would start talking about how that has influenced your view on things. And even in the last show, your tale of, well, losing your job because of an ill-timed drug test that they just happened to spring. What was it? What was the holiday the night before?
Oh, I don't know. It was what, Memorial Day or Labor Day week. I actually confused those.
Okay.
I don't know. I'm an American, so it just means that's like a random day. There are random 2 days throughout the year that you get off for a holiday that I'm not exactly sure what that means. But yeah, so it was either Memorial Day or Labor Day. But so just to say, so my background in pharmaceuticals was basically I was in college. I had started college, and I come from a family that had no money, and even to take out loans and stuff, it was hard for me to find someone to co-sign my loans. And basically, you know, just, okay, so I'd try to find as good a job as I could. And I had a friend who was working in a pharmacy, not actually in the pharmacy part, just working as like a cashier. And someone else to work there. And I said, okay, yeah, can you hook me up with the job? So I started there, and a few weeks in, one of the technicians, one of the pharmacy technicians, basically, I don't know if you know, so you have a pharmacist and you have a pharmacy technician. It's basically, you do have to be licensed in certain states. But basically, you're doing all the work the pharmacist does. You're reading the prescriptions. You enter the prescriptions into the computer. You bill them to the insurance company. You count them out, put them together, do all this stuff. And then just before it goes to the patient, the pharmacist comes and checks what you've done to make sure you're not killing anybody. That's basically how that works. And so one of those guys left, and they said they thought I was a really competent employee in the store, and said, you know, hey, would you like to train to do this? So I said, sure. You know, it meant more money, and I was like, okay, yeah, do that. You know, I was a young kid. And did that, and that, you know, certainly helped to pay for college. Didn't get me all the way there, but it helped. And then when I ended up actually dropping out of college because I couldn't afford it, and I didn't feel like it was actually giving me an education. I really feel like I was getting dumber and dumber every year of college, and that was before I was a pothead, mind you. just saying. So I felt like college was dumbing me down and draining every amount of energy, and every dollar I could make, it was gone. And so whatever. So I dropped out, and then I had been working as a pharmacy technician for a few years. And, you know, our store, we were an independent pharmacy, which is still selling horribly toxic pharmaceutical drugs. I don't mean to paint it in any other light than that, but to say the store itself was much more ethical. And then the guy who owned the place was in his 80s, and he decides to sell it to this huge corporation. And then that corporation came in, and everything changed. And it was really, really a different environment. But I sort of I kind of tricked them into giving me a fuckload more money when the store got bought out. So I stayed. And for a guy my age, I was making really solid cash, and you know, that was where it was at the point. And then I got hot. At some point, I couldn't stand it there anymore. That was just kind of crazy control from that corporation. And then I left and worked for an insurance company, and I did that for about a year and a half, and worked in a cubicle. And what my job sort of was on a technical side was doing insurance billing, but ultimately what I realized my job was to deny sick people medicine. And at the time, this was still, I'm not thinking how toxic these medicines are. I'm thinking, this is medicine. And now I'm working for an insurance company, and my job is to make sure that the insurance company doesn't have to pay for it.
that the customer has to pay for. So you find all these excuses to not pay these insurance claims. And I was like, this is really fucked up. So I left there and I started working for a pharmacy, another independent pharmacy, where my job was to fight the insurance companies and to make sure that the claims could get paid. So I felt like I was, at that point, I'm like, okay, this is the right thing to do, fight for all these cancer patients who are getting charged thousands and thousands and thousands, I mean huge amounts of money for these cancer medications that the insurance company doesn't want to pay for. So here I am, now I'm fighting the insurance company, thinking I'm helping the cancer patient. And I did that for a few years, and then, you know, at that point I start to become more educated in a lot of this stuff, and then I realized, oh my God, you know, the cancer patient shouldn't even be taking this stuff.
Right.
You know, and it's like, wait a second. And like, then the whole thing starts to unravel. And I had a sort of momentary crisis, left there, ended up getting, had a lot of trouble finding other work. I did go back to work in a pharmacy. And then I was trying to be a little bit of a, you know, evangelical within the pharmacy complex. So you'd have, you know, people, when a customer came in and said, what can I take for this? And I'd say, don't buy anything from this store. You know, go home, drink orange juice, whatever it is, whatever I could try and do to convince people not to take medicine.
That's awesome.
But it was such a losing game because my bosses hated it. You know, of course, they want you to be a salesman. And the other thing is I found that the customers didn't like it. They're like, no, right, I came to the pharmacy. Give me something that's going to make me better. And I'm like, this stuff isn't going to make you better. Like, right, you have to either change your diet or, you know, there's a lot of things you could do, but buying some product off the shelf here is not going to make you better.
You don't stay like, in that kind of job for very long if that's right. Your approach.
I'd have people say, like, if you're not going to tell me, I'm just going to go to the pharmacy across the street. I'm like, well, I am telling you. Don't, like, what the fuck is wrong with you? So, you know, you get into this whole thing. And then I ended up losing that job because of, that was the job I lost because of failing a drug test. But,
probably wanted to get rid of you anyway.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So, as I'm saying, that's when I said I didn't think that drug test was random.
Right.
Because the thing is, I was, amongst my direct supervisors, I was very open about the fact that I smoked marijuana. My thing is, I would have conversations about it. I would say, I would try and talk to the pharmacists about the medications that they're giving people and saying, hey, you're handing this stuff out by the handful every fucking day. What do you think about this? What do you think about this study? What do you, whatever? And more often than not, they didn't want to have the conversation because they're making $100-something thousand a year. Don't question $100,000 a year, particularly if it took you 6 years of college. At this point, here in New York, and I think throughout the United States, you actually have to get a doctorate to become a pharmacist. Now it's a doctor of pharmacy. So now it's a six-year program. It's incredibly expensive schooling, tremendously hard to pass all these tests. But I would sit there and, you know, we would have pharmacy students come in and they'd be training with us. And I got to see the textbooks, and I'd say, like, grab the students' textbooks and go, look at the first page. You know, you open any book, it says who the publisher is. Like, your textbook is the company, the publisher of your textbook is the company that makes the pharmaceuticals. This is not, wow. This is biased information. I was like, if you're studying about what they are telling you about their products, you're not actually learning anything about their products. And
right.
Most kids would say, I don't have time for this conversation. I have a test tomorrow.
Right.
Yeah. It's a sales manual from the sound of it.
It's totally a sales manual, yeah. I worked with this Greek pharmacist and I said, hey, you're Greek, right? And she's like, yeah. And I'm like, what does pharmaiki mean in Greek? And she's like, well, it means poison. But that's not what it means. And, you know, like, so I was just trying to have these conversations. And I was open about the fact that I would smoke marijuana because I'm saying, listen, so, you know, you're the fucking drug expert here. Study it. This is not dangerous. So I was always trying to instigate these conversations. Amongst my direct supervisors, it was a known fact and no one had an issue with it. But I think particularly because I was really good at my job, they do all sorts of things where they can quantify, like, how, not only like how fast will you work, but how accurate you are. Any mistake is taken, you know, very seriously. So they, everything's kept really tight track of. And since I had the lowest amount of mistakes, the fastest rate, the highest accuracy rate, basically people put up with my personality. But
because you weren't showing any of these supposed cognitive deficits that come with marijuana use.
Yeah. Right. So then the higher ups instituted this drug test, and when they were trying to fire me for it, I said, please look at all my quantifiable data. Like, you do all this stuff to make sure you can check every step of my work to figure out if you like me or not, or you know, because if I'm not doing these things right, you're going to come down on my, you know, and yell at me. So obviously marijuana is not affecting my, it's not impairing my judgment at all, or my intellect at all, my motor skills at all. Any of these things are not being impaired. That should be pretty fucking obvious by your own standards. So what, you know, what would be your reason for firing me? It's obviously not impairing my judgment.
Right.
And they're like, no, you know, no, we have a zero tolerance policy. That no conversation. There's no debating it. You're just fired.
Yeah.
But that's okay. I mean, now basically I am a starving artist, which is why I took raised that issue before of, I don't think a starving artist is the ideal, but just to say, it was very, it would be really hard for me. Every now and then I think about it. I actually got a call last year from this pharmacy that would have offered me crazy fucking money to come and work for them, and I just can't do it anymore. Like, it would be really hard for me to say, like, to justify that to myself. I'd much rather, you know, we were talking all these different things about, you know, art and stuff like that. I'd rather create my art and struggle to get by than what I feel is essentially poisoning people and getting paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's a personal decision. I mean, everyone said to me, if you don't do it, someone else is going to do it. You might as well just do it. But that doesn't the logic doesn't work for me.
Yeah, apparently nature abhors a vacuum. I don't know.
Well,
do jobs have zero tolerance policies for DUIs, you think?
Probably not.
Oh. Certain ones definitely do. Fucking taxi, I'll tell you that.
Well, actually, do you know, my brother worked for this company years back where he said they were imposing all these layoffs, and he was considering starting to drink heavily on the job because he said once – if you get found out to have if you're an alcoholic – they actually couldn't fire you. They have to pay for your rehab and do all this stuff because it's like, well, you have a problem and it's a medical – alcoholism is considered a medical problem. So right. they actually have to take care of you, and they can't fire you in that window. If they fire you, you could sue them because you're sick and they fired you. So he was considering avoiding a layoff by pretending to be an alcoholic.
That's awesome. A movie right there. I want to see that. That's genius, man.
Totally.
But wow. Think about the implications of that. No one cares if you're drunk.
Like, you know, the DUI is essentially attempted murder on some level, you know? Yeah. You are a loaded weapon hurtling down the streets, and you had full conscious awareness that you were going to be in a car at some point. And, you know, people have a lot of... I think people used to have a little bit more sympathy for that. Just because people, well, at least in my environment, in my own world, that, you know, hate to say it, but having a few in you while you drive home is a fairly common occurrence, you know? It's pretty sick.
You're still allowed to have a certain amount. I mean, that's a thing. You can't go above a certain level, which makes sense. But there used to be more of a focus on the spirit of the law rather than the letter of the law in general. And that's changed greatly due to people's like quotas and all kinds of just, you know, issues. And also just that there's kind of an us and them attitude from both sides. And so people tend, it tends to be coming out of other places than just like, you know, what, like law enforcement, you know, law enforcement's become some other level of enforcement that's beyond what it used to be in that regard for the most part. So, but some police officers, depending on where you're at, are still treat it in the old fashion, you know, which I appreciate sometimes.
Depends on what you look like, right?
Well, there's a lot of profiling that goes on, but I think that that's always kind of been the case, you know, in general. Like, people get profiled. Like, if you look a certain way, you get treated a certain way, depending on who it is that you're dealing with. So it's kind of the way it goes. But just to get back to the pharmaceutical thing really quick, it was a trip working with disabilities for years. Like, I would have to go to the pharmacy and, like, pick up, like, a fucking rainbow assortment of fucking pills that was just, like, unbelievable. Like, and watch these people take literally a handful of pills at once and then go from, like, a relatively, like, you know, reasonable thing to, like, something else. Like, I would watch these people, like, transform in the course of, like, an hour into something that a lot of times was unmanageable, and or they were just, like, it didn't seem to be helping at all. It seemed to be every time doing the opposite. And, like, I was like, why are they fucking taking this shit? And I would look at the price of what their parents were paying for this, and it was just, like, un-fucking fathomable. I'm like, whoa, dude, like, that's a wow. And then I ended up quitting this one company that I was working for and going over to another. And this guy I work with, same form of autism, same disabilities as, like, a number of other people I had worked with, like, pretty, you know, he was mentally disabled for sure. And he was given all natural medications. This guy was, like, on fish oil and all this stuff. And he took a lot of stuff, but none of it was pharmaceutical. And all of it was comparatively inexpensive. And I would actually see a noticeable improvement when he would take it. And it was totally observable. You know, he could manage. The only pharmaceutical that he took was Depakote. Which has issues, like, in terms of long-term use and overtaking it, but it did actually stop him from having seizures. It's like, it really does work. Like, he was having seizures, started taking Depakote, no more seizures, which I've seen happen with a number of cases. But other than that, yeah, it was really inspiring, to work with that guy. I'm like, wow, that's an example, you know, but that kind of information, people who are coming from a place of deep concern for their children especially, aren't usually even willing to listen to alternative stuff because it feels like that it's not going to do the same thing or that it's lesser. And, like, I've noticed that in general with all kinds of issues, like cold and flu even, where you're just like, you can take a more natural approach and you'll see better results. And, like, you know, there's something to be said for that for sure.
Let's take a 5-minute break, go to the bathroom, get a cup of coffee, and we'll meet back in just a little bit.
Sure.
Okay. You're here.
All right.
Sounds good.